Well, the answer to that is Aleister Crowley. Yes, the Beast 666 himself. In addition, he's also the one that showed the peace sign to Winston Churchill during World War II. When you look into occult history, it's actually the sign of Typhon. Now, the rock and roll industry is full of mysteries from its birth even to today. Here's one that I've always liked. Paul is dead. Paul McCartney. According to the story, he died in a car accident in the mid-60s and was replaced by Billy Shears. Is it true? Is it not? We don't know. I do. I don't think it's real. But nonetheless, that story, that legend, if you will, is still alive today. And when you peel back the onion, of the music industry, from the Laurel Canyon days to the Mickey Mouse Club, Christina Aguilera, Britney Spears, and all these interesting organizations and people that surround them, it makes one think, are we being told the truth when it comes to the music industry? Is there some dark hand behind it? Aleister Crowley, he comes through the music industry over and over and over again. He was on the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Heart Club album. Look up in the corner, there's a picture of old Aleister. He was followed by Jimmy Page, none other than himself. A lot of big names follow dark, esoteric philosophies. And a lot of strange things happen in the music business. The 27 Club, the list goes on and on. We're going to get into that. And my guest tonight has a deep, deep understanding and knowledge of that. So hang around. It's going to be fun. It's going to get weird. It's going to be a little bit interesting, but y'all know how I like that. Today, in this strange time we're looking at, one thing that is under attack, not only our minds, but our bodies. And health is something that I've taken seriously for a few years now, because I realized ain't nobody going to save this boy, and the death care system ain't going to make me healthy. They're going to reset a broken arm just fabulously, but are they going to make me healthy? No. So I started using products from Chemical Free Body. Tim James is an amazing dude, and you know me, I'm skeptical. A few years ago, I was at an Acapulco. My friend Charlie says, hey, you got to meet this cat. You got to try this stuff. I'm like, okay, I'll try it. Yeah, I got home. Started taking his Green 85, which is now organic energy juice. I do think he rebranded it. And lo and behold, it worked. I've been taking it every day for 2.5 years. And I recently got the Water Hero, which is a little device you just pour your water through. And it takes my tap water and makes it taste like I drew it out of a fresh spring. And more importantly, I've felt the benefits of that. Now, I won't give the graphic details, but these products work. So if you're serious about your health, go to chemicalfreebody.com/natureboy. That's my page. Give it a poke. If you find something you like, use the promo code natureboy at checkout and you'll get some good savings. More importantly, you'll get products that will work and will make you healthy. And then two, every sale, I get a little something to help me cover the expenses of the show, because I'm not speaking craziness to anybody. We know how expensive things are getting and it's hitting my bottom line. So that's chemicalfreebody.com/natureboy, promo code natureboy. So everybody that's in the chats, all you beautiful savages, everybody that's listening to this, thank you so much for continuing to show to help the show grow. I mean, it still amazes me that I see the numbers that I see just tuning in live and down the road, and it just makes this old man happy. So thank you very much. I can be found at X at The Real Nature Boy, or my handle is NBN Nature Boy, as in Naughty by Nature. I love my comments. I love it when I get the good comments, and you know I love the bad comments, because hate listeners, y'all welcome on this show. So everybody, from the bottom of my heart, thank you for tuning in. Share the show, share the show, share the show, share my comments on X and that, all that stuff, and just help me get this show, continually make this show grow. Okay, so that's all out of the way. I think I got everything done. Now let's get on with the show. Tonight's guest is Richard Serrett. He's a longtime host of Strange Planet. He's also a frequent guest on Coast to Coast AM and the creator of The Conspiracy Show. Richard's first book, and I'll let him tell you about it, Tales from the Rock and Roll Twilight Zone, digs into the strange history and dark side of the music industry. With years of calm, thoughtful interviews on hidden truths and the unexplained, he always brings a steady voice to the conversation. Richard, welcome, my friend, to the third rail.
Nature boy, great to be here.
Likewise, likewise, man. As I was, you know, researching you, and when I got the first, you know, from Todd, our friend, who put out the, you know, the promo, I was like, oh, I got to get this cat on, man. He's right up my line. I love music. I love funky stuff, and I love the convergence of it. I love, Richard, talking to people like you who know far more about it than I do. So for my audience out there that may not be familiar with you, who is Richard Serrett? And more importantly, where can you be found and where can they get this cool book of yours, man?
Who is Richard Serrett? He is an enigma wrapped in a riddle, dipped in a chocolatey coating. I am a lover of terrestrial radio. I worked my entire adult career, my entire adult life, really, in radio. Started out at a big 50,000 watt blowtorch station, worked behind the scenes as a producer, eventually got my own show. Had to figure out how am I going to fill 2 hours of airtime on a Sunday night. And aside from Art Bell in those days, there was no one really talking about alternative everything in radio. So that sort of became my raison d'etre, is to explore those, the big questions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what happens after we die? Why are we here? Are we alone in the universe? Who is in control here on Earth? All of these questions. So that sort of evolved into The Conspiracy Show eventually, that radio program, then later became a television show. In 2014, I started my stint as a regular guest host on Coast to Coast. I fill in for George Norrie and others 2-3 times a month. And it's an amazing platform with an amazing legacy. In 2018, I started a podcast called The Rock and Roll Twilight Zone, which kind of became this convergence of my love for classic rock and also my love for, you know, exploring the subterranean, if you will, conspiracies, the paranormal, secret societies, the occult. All of these things came together, and the podcast was about 40 episodes, and I distilled that into about 16, well, not about, precisely 16 chapters, and this little baby right here, Tales from the Rock and Roll Twilight Zone, which is available to book buyers as of July 9th, but it's available on pre-order.
Where can they find it? Where can you get the pre-orders, and where is it going to be available?
It's going to be just about everywhere online. The usual suspects: Amazon, Walmart, Barnes and Noble. I like to direct people directly to the publisher, Trineday.com. They can order it there. They can also get more information at therockandrolltwilightzone.com.
Nice. I like Chris Milligan. He's a good man.
Oh, he's the best.
He's the best. I had him on a few weeks ago, and I used to live up in Oregon, and it's basically the same town he did, so we got something in common. You know, especially back in the day when I had no clue who this cat Babs was, and Mike Hagan. I just knew him as that's old Mike and that's Babs. And then I found out, oh, they're part of the Merry Pranksters. And you mean Mike Hagan? The reason you ever saw his face on camera is because he's the one that filmed everything, and you got Babs and you have this King Kesey thing. And I just fell into it. And I was like, oh, in fact, I remember I have a vivid memory of being at Mike's house when the day after, I think it was the day after or so, that Jerry died. And, you know, the official story was he died of a heart attack, natural causes. Let's cremate the body. Nothing to see here. Okay. That was the official story. And I'm hanging out with Mike and Babs and a few other people. And they're like, yeah, that's bullshit. He OD'd, blah, blah, blah. And they just went through the whole story about how they, you know, what happened. And I looked at them and I'm like, okay, you are people that are on the inside. You know what's going on. And you're telling me one story. And the media is telling me another one. And the thing is, who am I going to believe? My eyes are the lion media. So I go along that, the vein that, yeah, they broke him out. Jerry had some stash. He died and they cremated him and they made up a story and nothing to see. I mean, just, it's like rock and roll. That's why there's so many stories that have fascinated me. And let's start with going back to the 60s, kind of where the big British invasion came from, when rock and roll went from more or less the race music classifications to Bill Haley to when it exploded globally. And that's with the Beatles. I've heard and done a lot of research on the early times of the Beatles, and also something that is most of my listeners will know about it, but it's the Tavistock Institute and how the Beatles weren't an organic group of the Fab Four who just came out of Liverpool with this amazing new sound and these great lyrics and took the world by surprise. That actually, they may have had a little bit of help, if you know what I mean. So what's your take on that whole thing?
Well, my take is, and this is chapter one in the book, it's called Fab Four or False Flag. And I leaned on some pretty heavy researchers for this chapter. Nelson Thal, first and foremost, I should mention Nelson. He's a friend of mine. Just to give you just a glimpse of who this guy is, he helped smuggle the Zapruder film, or a copy that Jim Garrison made of the Zapruder film, into Canada, where it was broadcast for the first time. It wasn't Geraldo Rivera in 1975.
Oh, I always this thought it was Geraldo.
Well, that was, I guess, the most prominent time people saw it in the mid-70s. But Nelson went down to Love Airfield in Dallas. JFK researcher Penn Jones handed him a copy. Remember, during the trial in 68 in New Orleans, Jim Garrison made copies of the Zapruder film, and then he wanted to disseminate them to get them out to researchers. This was all done sort of surreptitiously. So Nelson came up here and he gave it to a border TV station, a CBC station, I believe it was in Windsor, and told the program director, once the test pattern comes up, wait a few minutes and then play the Zapruder film. And then at the same time, he alerted all of his fellow researchers in this area at all the universities and so forth, and instructed them to hit record on their, in those days, they had huge VTR videotape recorders. So they all recorded it. Now, if you were up at 3 o'clock in the morning and you happened to be watching that border station in Windsor, you saw the test pattern go down and then you saw the Zapruder film and you're probably thinking, what the heck was that? Well, all of these researchers hit record. And so that one transmission of the Zapruder film probably ended up being recorded by 50 different researchers. And that's how the Zapruder film was first sort of disseminated to researchers. My friend Nelson. And Nelson was... is a fascinating guy. He was the last PhD candidate student under Marshall McLuhan, the great media guru up here in Canada. And Marshall McLuhan, the media is the message, the medium is the message. And he, of course, believed that the arts were controlled by the secret societies. So this is sort of the lineage, Marshall McLuhan to Nelson Thal. I interviewed Nelson about the Beatles, and he believed that while the Beatles were incredibly talented, you can't take anything away from them.
No.
But they had the machine behind them. And whether we're talking about EMI or the British Crown or the Tavistock Institute, somebody decided that if the British were ever going to get the colony back, the American colony that they lost when General Cornwallis surrendered to Lafayette in 1781, keep in mind, he surrendered to a French general, not to George Washington.
Interesting. Now.
They wanted the colony back. And if you look at the War of 1812, if you look at the Civil War, you could look at that as a, look at it through the lens of the British attempting to reclaim the American colony. So the British invasion in 1964 was not just a metaphorical British invasion, it was an actual British invasion. And the Beatles had been weaponized in order to subvert American youth. Remember, they were traumatized. This is sort of classic MK Ultra protocol writ large. Instead of being targeted on certain individuals, you're targeting an entire culture, the youth culture. They've been traumatized by the assassination of Kennedy just 3 months earlier. Now here they are on the stage, the Ed Sullivan stage in February of 64. And within 3 years, we saw the Beatles evolve from these innocent, you know, lyrics and "She loves you, yeah, 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 and I want to hold your hand." They evolved or devolved perhaps into psychedelia, LSD, sexual permissiveness, challenging authority, questioning the church. Mm-hmm. And the youth culture evolved right along with them. And that was the whole intention, subvert the youth. If you want to control and steer society, if you want to modify behavior, you don't use politics, you control culture. And that's what was at play there.
Which is why, you know, the question is asked, I remember a long time ago, what would make the establishment, lack of a better term, want to assassinate someone like a Jimi Hendrix or Elvis Presley or whatever? And the answer is very simple. It's the influence that these people wield is far greater by times 10 than any politician can. Yeah. And as Adolf Hitler says, and this goes back to your point about social engineering, the quote, the paraphrase of Hitler when he says, "I don't care about you adults because I have your kids." And that was the Hitlerjugend. And when you look at the history of the Hitlerjugend, Hitler Youth, and that whole time, they were the last ones that were fighting ferociously in Berlin when the rest of the Third Reich had already fallen. So yes, if you want to control the future or steer the future populations, that is the way you do it. And it's also, I find a correlation, and I'd like to hear your viewpoint on it, is there's a reason why pop culture is targeted towards our youth and not us adults. What's your viewpoint on that?
Well, I mentioned the Tavistock Institute, and the Tavistock Institute was created ostensibly after the Second World War, and they had shell-shocked soldiers returning home after the war, and they were trying to figure out, you know, how can we heal these broken men and put their psyches back together? At a certain point, somebody had the brilliant idea, well, if we can put a psyche back together, can we take it apart and put it back together in a way that we want? Can we mold human behavior? Can we steer entire populations? And so I sort of think of it as the Ministry of Defense meets Sigmund Freud. And they quickly realized that melodies in particular, I mean, we know how sound and frequencies can affect the human brain, but they also understood how certain melodies can bypass human reasoning. It can bypass the intellect and can manipulate emotions. through repetitiveness. And so the theory is that they brought in someone like, for example, Theodore Adorno, who was a Marxist and a social critic from the Frankfurt School. Mm-hmm. And while he didn't write the music for the Beatles, perhaps his influence was in determining those musical codes and melodies that could, again, bypass human reasoning, affect emotion, create, they knew what, for example, what musical chords or codes could create melancholy, mm-hmm. For example, or aggression. And so, again, the Beatles, instead of red coats and muskets, the British Empire was now using backbeats and Rickenbacker guitars.
Oh, nice. Always got to love in the little violin thing. Well, there's you talked about frequencies and how you can subvert the conscious mind and affect the emotions in the subconscious mind directly. And you are so on point on that. The example I like to use, and I used to do a lot of live music production, is that gifted artist, that singer, if you will, that can go to an audience regardless of the size and have absolute 100% control of their emotions. They can raise them up into a fury. They can quiet them down into the still of apathy. They can make them cry. They can make them laugh. They literally have the ability to pull out whatever emotion they want out of the audience and play with them. And that's a very powerful force. Now, when you take that idea and you put it into a social engineering model, back it up with a lot of high-tech science and research, the power is absolutely tremendous. And, you know, when you look at the youth, the music of one's youth stays with somebody their entire life. That's when it is branded. And I think that in itself is a great example of the power that the people in the Tavistock industry and in early social engineering and also in the occult, because them witches know all about what specific frequencies do whatever to them. So I got off on a little bit of a tangent there, but so is there a specific example, a concrete example of the Beatles that maybe would be a good demonstration, a song, a riff, or whatever?
A song or a riff that I don't get into too specific detailing of, you know, melodies or chords. I was talking mainly about the institutions and some of the figures that were involved, and how. So you see this sort of overlapping of people in the Tavistock Institute also involved in MK Ultra, and it was the system, the institutions, the scientists, the behavioralists that were involved. But as for a certain, you know, a particular riff, I guess you could look at all their music really in that way. I don't think anything was left to chance. I think it was all designed. I mean, particularly once we got into sort of the psychedelic period and, you listen to, tracks like Tomorrow Never Knows and, the backward masking, and almost these binaural beats that we hear. It's almost like, what's the word I'm looking for here? I'm struggling a little bit, but in training the human brain, I think Sergeant Pepper is a perfect example. Most of the tracks on there.
I think that was a very formidable album. Mm. It really changed that I saw the style of the Beatles, and it had a massive influence in culture. You know, And there were so many. If you just look at the album cover, the almost sublime design of that, when you really get into it, people have probably studied that for years on what does every little symbol mean? How is it correlated? I mean, hell, they had Aleister Crowley sitting up there in the corner. That to me, when I saw that, I was like, oh, they're into Crowley too, huh? I was like, damn, who wasn't back in those days and stuff like that. You know, and, you know, another thing that I mentioned in my monologue, which shows the leg, if you will, lack of a better term, on the power of that band and the mythology surrounding the band is the Paul is Dead legend. Mm-hmm. First time I heard about that was many years ago. And, you know, first of all, I went to my big grain of salt bucket. Interesting story. Don't know it's true. Can't dismiss it, but I'll entertain the idea. Personally, I don't think that I've never seen any concrete evidence which says that that is true. I lean more towards, no, it's not. It was a good story that was created somewhere, somehow, which to this day, what, 60, 70 years ago, still has leg. So what's your view on that whole Paul is Dead, lack of a better term, PSYOP?
Well, PSYOP is maybe the key to this whole discussion. But let me back up and say, sure. Mm-hmm. I don't believe Paul McCartney died in a car crash on November 9th, 1966. In order to believe that, you have to believe that Brian Epstein or George Martin or EMI or the remaining Beatles managed to find a replacement who also played left-handed bass, who looked an awful lot like Paul McCartney and was arguably even more talented than the original Paul McCartney. I mean, yes, pre-1966, Paul McCartney wrote Yesterday, which is the most covered song, I believe, in popular music history. But if you look at the body of work post-1966, Hey Jude, Let It Be, The Long and Winding Road, everything he did with Wings, some of his great solo albums, it stretches credulity to believe. I'm open to the possibility. However, what I found most fascinating about the Paul is Dead legend is that, as you say, it still has legs. Mm-hmm. 60 years. And this mythos or this legend erupted at a, you know, we're talking 40 years before the advent of the of social media, 30 years before the internet was, you know, in wide use. Imagine a legend like that that's still around today, perhaps just as strong as it was 60 years ago. It really sort of took off in 1969 with a phone call to a radio station in Detroit, Michigan. But imagine starting a rumor or a legend or a myth, one voice at a time, one, you know, somebody telling somebody else, a newspaper column picks it up. The fact that it took on this life of its own, I find is absolutely fascinating. Now, the PSYOP aspect is interesting because what is the motive behind this? Was it just clever marketing? Did the Beatles say, let's leave a trail of breadcrumbs and, you know, this legend will take off and people will be buying up albums like crazy with a magnifying glass looking for clues on the cover of Sgt. Pepper, or they'll be listening to Strawberry Fields backwards. Did he just say, I buried Paul? Or did he say cranberry sauce? Was it just clever marketing? Were the Beatles just, you know, having some fun because they were comedians? You know, they loved Peter Sellers and Peter Cook. And this would be right up their alley, pulling a stunt like this. Or was it, as you mentioned off the top, a PSYOP? Were the executives at EMI or whomever was behind this trying to figure out if they could steer a population and have them just falling all over themselves, looking for these clues, following these breadcrumbs? We were being led by our nose. If they can do that, I mean, what a wonderful laboratory for them. Mm-hmm. To use the Beatles and to use this legend to try and create a PSYOP. I mean, I think that explanation is as good as any, but I believe Paul McCartney is alive and well, But the clues are there. The clues are real. The question is, who put them there and why?
Yeah, exactly. It's like when they're walking on that crosswalk on Abbey Road, that's one of the people. All of the legs except Paul's are in the same direction and his is opposite. The fact that, I'm gapping on George Harrison referred to him as full. It's full, as in fake Paul.
Yeah. John Lennon is dressed as the sort of as the vicar, mm-hmm. Ringo Starr as the mourner. Paul McCartney, of course, is the deceased. He's not wearing shoes. You're never buried with your shoes when they put you in the casket. No shoes. George Harrison sort of dressed as the grave digger. There's a Volkswagen Beetle on the side of the road and on the license plate. The license plate reads 28IF, 28 if. Well, Paul McCartney would have been 28 had he lived. So that's just one album cover with a few clues, but there's a multitude of clues scattered in their music and their lyrics. It just goes on and on and on. And it's just, it's so captivating. People to this day, you know, they take that straight edge mirror and they hold it up to Sergeant Pepper and they place it along the middle of the bass drum where it says Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. And when you look at the reflection on the upper half of that bass drum, and it spells out the date of Paul McCartney's death.
Wow.
X1, and then it says he dies. 9/11, November 9th, 1966, he dies. I mean, come on, that's just not happenstance.
No, it's not happenstance, but think about just that. From a social engineering standpoint, if I take myself out of who I am and put myself into some sociopathic social engineer, doesn't give a rat's ass about his own agenda, what a beautiful petri dish to have, man. Mm. Especially at that time. I could see them going, hey, let's just play around and see the effects that we can have on culture with this. And hey, why don't we say Paul's dead? And then we'll put a whole bunch of breadcrumbs down here and have everybody chasing their tails, exploring this, like you said, buying the albums and going these things for years and years with a fine-tooth comb. Huh, let's try it. And I guess they did, and it worked, man. It really worked. But that's just an example of the timeliness in a funky sense of rock and roll and of art. You know, you could have a song that was written like, it wasn't long around, Hold My Hand. Still to this day is the most recorded song. That's the power of art, and that's the power of culture. And the Beatles was just, in my opinion, kind of like one of the first little psyops, if you will, that came. And then you have, of course, the opposite, which is Mr. Brian Jones and the Rolling Stones. And his mysterious death, you know, they were set up as the bad boys. You had the Beatles as the good boys. Then you had the Stones as the bad boys. What is that famous album in the 60s? Her Royal Satanic Wedding or something like that?
Oh, Her Majesty's Satanic Request. That was their response to Sergeant Pepper. They were in this friendly competition. So, yeah. Not nearly as good as Sergeant Pepper, but I think underrated, that album.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, kind of like a Don King boxing match. You know?
Yes.
You know, we're rivals. We hate each other. But really, they're still probably working for the same people. But we won't let that, because conflict is tension, and tension release is the art, is mm-hmm. the key of good music. Tension, release, tension, and release. And I just find that whole part of music interesting. Now, I believe in your book, you touched on Brian Jones's drowning. Did you not?
I did. Section 3 of the book is called Killer Riffs, and I re-examine the deaths of Brian Jones in July of 69, and then, of course, Jimi Hendrix in September of 1970, to early entrance into the 27 Club, and then Elvis in 77 and Kurt Cobain in 94. Elvis, of course, not 27, he was 42, but Kurt Cobain also part of the 27 Club. But Brian Jones kicks off that section. And death by misadventure, accidental drowning, is the official cause of death. But one of the themes that runs throughout that section of the book is the rush to judgment. And with Brian Jones, that certainly was the case. You know, here was just another rock and roller who drank too much, who popped too many pills, found dead at the bottom of a pool, must have been drowning. Nothing to see here, folks. Let's move along. But as readers will discover, there is much to see here. And I'll leave you with this important note. The person who performed the autopsy on Brian Jones, swimming pool. He was living at Cotchford Farm, which was the old A.A. Milne estate. A.A. Milne, the great British writer who brought us Winnie the Pooh and Christopher Robin. Oh. And Brian Jones purchased that that farm to get away from London. He was being hassled by the police. The police and their superiors didn't like these long hairs influencing their children. So they were all too happy to plant drugs, or in some cases, they didn't need to plant drugs.
They just needed to supply them.
Exactly. So he moved down there, and he was in a very sort of vulnerable state. He had just been fired from the band. Mick and Keith drove down to Cotchford Farm to let him know he was done with the Rolling Stones. He was drinking so much at this point that he wasn't able to perform. He would come into the studio and it would take him 3 hours just to restring his guitar. So the band was getting fed up with Brian Jones, even though he was the founder. He was the heart and soul of the band. He was the flamboyant one. The only problem was he couldn't write songs. And the Rolling Stones were no longer a blues cover band. If you wanted to make it to the show, to the big time, you had to write your own music. That's where Keith and Mick came in, and Brian Jones basically got pushed aside. And so he retreated to Cotchford Farm. Now, I mentioned the autopsy when he was found at the bottom of the swimming pool. Ordinarily, they would have called in the coroner from, or the medical examiner, as we call them here, from Sussex. They didn't use that coroner. Instead, the Prime Minister of England at the time, Prime Minister Heath, appointed his own personal physician to conduct the autopsy.
That's interesting.
Why would he do that? Why would he do that? Why? Rush to judgment. It smells of cover-up.
Yeah. See, I haven't heard, I don't know very much but about Brian Jones' story. That's why when I saw that in your book, I was like, oh, this is interesting. So what do you think, or do you theorize, might have really been behind his forming the 27 Club?
Well, I think he was murdered. Whether it was murder in the first degree or whether it was manslaughter, but there was a cover up. There was quite a collection of individuals who were at Cotchford Farm that night, hangers on, nurses, ex-girlfriends, present girlfriends, and a gentleman by the name of Tom Keelock, who, I'm sorry, not Tom Keelock. Was it Mike Keelock? Anyway, he was the fixer for the Rolling Stones. He'd recently been fired. Keith Richards caught this character for basically skimming. And so he decided he would latch on to Brian Jones, who was in a very fragile state. So he goes down to Cotchford Farm. He's hanging out with them. There was also a collection of a crew of workers who were constantly renovating Cotchford Farm, and Brian couldn't get rid of them. And they were robbing Brian blind. They were inflating prices and finding all sorts of problems, you know, with the renovations. Oh, we got to tear this wall down and look what we found behind this wall. Now we got to fix that. He couldn't get rid of them. And there was a lot of tension there. And there was the head of the crew was named Frank Thorogood. And he and Brian would get into some pretty big shouting matches, almost came to fisticuffs a number of times. So was Frank Thorogood involved in Brian's death? Did they get into an altercation in the swimming pool or on the edge of the swimming pool? Frank Thorogood, on his deathbed, claims, allegedly, this is the report, I wasn't there at his deathbed, but it is said that he confessed to killing Brian Jones. So, you know, why the cover up? Well, we explore that in the book, but there was also a brother of Tom Keelock. His name is Frank Keelock. He worked with Scotland Yard. He was a detective with Scotland Yard. Did he call his brother at Scotland Yard and say, we have a problem down here? You know,
the fixer calling the fixer?
The fixer calling the ultimate fixer, who called the prime minister, who basically had the whole nasty affair swept under the rug.
That's pull when you can Heath, and I believe he was a big time pedophile, if I got my prime ministers right. That's a hell of a pull when you can call your brother and he picks up the phone, and the prime minister picks it up, and the prime minister takes charge of the cover up. So it begs me, and I'm sure you have the same question. Why? He was just a long haired rock star that overdosed and fell into a pool. And, you know, what's the big deal? You know, there's a million of them. So did it go up to the top of the
top? The key to this, and again, you know, this book is not a manifesto. I don't claim to have a monopoly on the truth. I'm simply asking questions. We're trying to connect some dots, and we leave it up to the readers to decide. It appears included in that crowd that July night in 1969 was an undercover member of the constabulary. Was he trying to find drugs on Brian Jones? Was there something else he was trying to find? He's on the scene. Now all of a sudden there's a murder, manslaughter, murder in the second degree. How does he explain his presence there? He's now a witness. Is he going to be called to testify? You can see how the whole situation just gets out of hand, gets very complicated. Yeah. And so they had to cover this whole thing up.
And if the cover-up started, the investigation started at the top, it would make sense that you would have the top that would cover it up.
Mm-hmm. It has to be.
That's a fascinating story. I mean, just the amount of deaths. When Janis Joplin died, I have a friend who's previously passed, but he was a blues legend named Mick Martin. And I was talking to him one day, and he was like, yeah, I was at the hotel. I was upstairs in a hotel room right above Janis when she died. I was like, dude, really? He was like, yeah, it was just like a normal day. We woke up in the morning, come out, and there's all this activity going on. And I was like, he's like, well, what's going on? They're like, dude, you haven't heard? He's like, no, he said, Janis is dead. Mm-mm. And she was a 27er, wasn't she?
She was.
Now, yeah. I have a, now that we're getting in that 27 club, this is something that's always fascinated me. I have been a big time Jimi Hendrix fan. I think, for his time, he was one of the few freaks of nature that we get blessed with in music that completely changes the whole game. And that was Jimi Hendrix. So I'm not sure if I was when I read it in Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon or maybe another book, but it talks about his manager. Actually, this is the story, having Jimi killed. And some people have said the question is why. It's just simple. He's worth more money dead than alive. And then two, at the time, I believe Jimi was about ready to let the guy go. Do you know anything about that whole Jimi Hendrix death? Is there something behind it that we're not being told?
Yeah, that's the story. His manager was a former British intel killer. One of these guys who, you know, when he got into the cups, he would happily tell you that he could kill you with his finger, you know, his baby finger. People believed him. He did serve during the Suez Crisis in 1956 with the British, and he was basically a trained killer. And I spoke with Jimmy's former road manager, James Tappy Wright, who is no longer with us. But at the time I spoke to him back in 2017, 2018, he was kind of the last man standing. Jimi, of course, long gone. All the members of Jimi Experience, Jimi Hendrix Experience, dead. I believe Monica Daneman is still alive, Jimmy's ex-girlfriend. I'm not sure about Kathy Etchingham. I think they're both alive. But anyway, James is no longer with us either. So, but he believed Mike Jeffrey when Mike Jeffrey told him to his face in private, I had to do it, Jimmy, or James. I had to do it. He called him Tappy Wright. I had to do it, Tappy. And Tappy Wright said, what do you mean? What are you talking about, Mike? He said, I had no other choice. I had to do it. He just kind of left it there, but Tappy Wright knew what he meant. This story that Jimi Hendrix took too many barbiturates one night and then aspirated on his own vomit. It's interesting that when he was taken to the hospital, I think it was St. Mary's in London, where he was staying with his girlfriend, Monica Daneman, before he departed for the Isle of Wight Music Festival. He never made it, of course, but the medical attendants found Jimmy's hair soaked with red wine. His clothes were soaked with red wine. There was no red wine in his blood. There was no red wine in his stomach. There was red wine in his lungs. As if someone may be familiar with a technique we now refer to as waterboarding, poured red wine right down Jimmy's nose, down his throat, and he basically drowned. He was drowned after being sedated by barbiturates. So why would Mike Jeffrey have that done? As you alluded to, Jimmy's contract with Mike Jeffrey was soon to expire. Mm-hmm. And Jimmy finally got wise to the game that Mike Jeffrey was playing with him. Again, it's almost like classic MK Ultra. Mike Jeffrey had Jimi Hendrix exhausted. He was constantly touring, performing. He had these crazy tour schedules where he would be out on the West Coast and then he would suddenly have to go to the East Coast. This was all by design. He wanted to keep, he had Jimmy signing things. He had no idea what he was signing. It was just like an an overload of stimulus. He couldn't keep up with what was happening. And this, again, it's MK Ultra. Like, it's almost like trauma. And he controlled Jimmy and he made Jimmy aware that without Mike Jeffrey, he would be tossed to the wolves. There was an incident in New York where Jimi Hendrix was kidnapped and he was being held by these mobsters. Jimmy later found out that it was Mike Jeffrey who arranged for his kidnapping so that he could come in and rescue Jimmy like a knight in shining armor. He then told Jimi Hendrix, you know, without me, you're not going to survive. I rescued you. You know, it became almost like this Stockholm syndrome. And when the contract was between the two was about to expire, Mike Jeffrey panicked. He owed the mob a lot of money. And oh, Jimi Hendrix was his. Jimi Hendrix was his cash cow. Well, the studio that Jimmy owned in New York, Electric Ladyland, had some structural issues, and Mike Jeffrey was constantly sending James Tappy Wright over to New Jersey to see his friends, and was always bringing back paper bags full of cash to pay the workers. This was the reconstruction of the studio was being paid for by the mob, and without Jimmy, Mike Jeffrey would have been in big trouble.
Yeah, the mob don't like it when you pay. Story that popped in my mind: I have a friend, Chuck Ocelli, and he grew up in Jersey, and he told me this story one time about Trump. He was at Atlantic City and there was a big Trump event. I think it was a restaurant. I'm not sure what it was. And he ran into some Italian businessmen that he knew growing up. And they're like, hey, Chucky Glasses. Cause the dude was blind and they called him Chucky Glasses. Hey, blind come on, Chucky Glasses. Yeah. They went to this like back room area and, you know, private thing. And here comes Donald Trump. Just glad-handed, everybody walked up, says hi, hi, hi. You know, this is back in the day, long, long time before he even had political aspirations. And they made an interesting statement when he walked away, because you could tell they had complete disdain for the guy. They said, yeah, that guy rips off everybody. That's just his way. The only people he doesn't rip off are us. This was a story to Chuck. I was like, yeah, that makes sense, because he knows what happens with a mob. I mean, you know, a bank, well, okay, we're going to foreclose legal things. The mob, no, you just disappear and you get stuffed in a 55-gallon barrel cut up with a bunch of cement. And that's, or you get buried in the column of a stadium. But yeah.
Yeah. What, yeah. An important detail I neglected to mention was that Mike Jeffrey had a life insurance policy on Jimi Hendrix. Otherwise, you know, why kill the golden calf if you're, or the golden cow if you're not going to profit from it. So, if Jimmy was going to sever ties with his manager, the manager better have, you know, a life insurance policy in place. And I mean, the record companies did as well. That was standard procedure. But for Mike Jeffrey to have a life insurance policy on him was a little unusual.
So do you think that Mike Jeffries did the hit, made the hit, or was he just a benefactor of the hit?
Could have been any or all of those. I don't know that he was necessarily there in that basement apartment in was it Harrowsmith, the Harrowsmith district of London, or Mayfair. Mm-hmm. May have ordered the hit. He may have been there, hard to say. But the other point I raise in the chapter is, could he have managed the cover up on his own without his intelligence connections? You know, that old saying, once CIA, always CIA, once in the mob, you don't retire, right?
Right.
So I suspect that Mike Jeffrey still had some pretty important connections. I'll give you an example of how connected he was. Yeah. Jimi Hendrix came to Toronto to perform, and he was busted at the airport. They found drug paraphernalia in his suitcase. We're talking about early 1970, and it was a setup. Jimmy was stunned that they found this in his suitcase, and he swore up and down, you know, to his girlfriend at the time, Kathy Etchingham, you know, I quit this stuff months ago or a year ago. This isn't mine. He probably could have, been sentenced, you know, to who knows, 10, 15 years in jail back in the '70s. That was a big deal. You know, to have drug paraphernalia. Now it's all legal. People are shooting up next to playgrounds. But back then it was a big deal. Mike Jeffrey, once again, swoops in like the knight in shining armor and somehow managed to pull strings and got Jimmy off. So there again, he tells Jimmy, you know, you'd be nothing without me. You know, you won't last a minute out on the street without me. So
typical Stockholm.
Yeah, type of it is. Syndrome. It's like MK Ultra type programming.
Well, I mean, considering that he was, I believe, MI6, so yeah. He comes from like hardcore intelligence, where we learned it from the British. Mm-hmm. So it's not out of the realms of possibility. In fact, it's within the realms of possibility, because once CIA, always CIA, once MI6, always CIA, MI6, he still has connections. And, also know that intelligence loves working with the mob. I mean, they're like Hung Dai. Just look at the JFK and that whole situation. So that's interesting. I mean, they're around, as you were talking about that, I couldn't help but see similarities with the Colonel and Elvis, where his whole life was controlled by this man. He kept him tired. He kept him ragged. He kept him on the road. I was talking about this earlier on the way kayaking with my friends, that Elvis Presley was a commodity. That's all that he was. He did not own his life. The Colonel owned his life and 25% of everything he made.
50.
50? 50?
Yes.
50. I thought it was 25. 50. Whoa.
Can you believe that? Eddie Arnold, early on in Elvis's career, when he signed on with the Colonel, Eddie Arnold, the great country singer, pulled him aside and said, son, this is not a good deal. What are you doing? He tried to talk him out of it. But Elvis was naive and he was appreciative. You know, he believed that Colonel had his best interest at heart. And of course he didn't.
Right.
Yeah.
Just like Jimmy thought Mr. Jeffries had their best interest at heart. when they didn't. There's a brilliant story about the Colonel from Dolly Parton, who I have the world of respect for musically, business-wise, right? Few things I disagree with her, especially when it comes to a few things that happened a few years ago. But she told this story about the song I Will Always Love You, the big Whitney Houston, her big thing, right? Well, back in the day, Elvis was going to record it. And she was like, wow, I mean, fantastic. Elvis Presley, this is the height of Elvis. So she gets a phone call from the Colonel. The Colonel said, hi, Dolly. Dolly, I just want you to know we're in the studio right now. We're getting ready to record your song. But before we do, Elvis needs 50% of your publishing rights. And being the brilliant woman that she was, she said in that country tone, oh, Colonel, that just breaks my heart, Colonel. I can't do that. You know, that's my moneymaker song. Oh, Colonel, I was so looking forward to hearing Elvis sing my song. Oh, I'm just so disappointed, Colonel. No. And literally walked away from it because she was an astute business person.
Yeah.
And she called it right off. Colonel, that is my moneymaker. And it was her moneymaker. And boy, considering the kahunas of anybody telling the Colonel at the height of Elvis's career, nah, I'm good. God can just go home. I'm going to keep that song. But he was a very, from what I understand, a manipulative person, probably a little bit sociopathic, like so many of those people in the music business are. You know, I've always found it being a paradox of the music industry, how on the onstage side, it's amazing the amount of love and influence and everything it has. I mean, a guy can walk up on stage and have 100,000 people all singing and dancing together and having the time of their life. But the backstage is probably, the music business is probably one of the most ruthless businesses out there. And you're talking about straight up sharks. I've known a lot of very, very accomplished and talented musicians. They're not good business people. That's it. Most of them aren't. Few exceptions like Miss Dolly and some other ones are. But so much of the time, the music industry understands that. They understand that, like, you have to give enough to the artist to think they're doing good, and they're not going to even question what's getting sent out the back door. It's like Stax Records, I believe it was. The guy that ran Stax. I'm sure this was Muddy Waters or who it was. But basically, he'd give them a salary and a brand new Cadillac every year. And these people thought that they were like, oh, my God, I've made it. Mm-hmm. They didn't know that, no, that guy, the reason he did that is that was like throwing chump change to these artists because the money that he was making on the back end was millions and millions of dollars. And in the music business, there's so many nefarious characters, whether it be from a business standpoint, whether it be from an intelligence standpoint. And since we're on the topics of people dying mysteriously in 27 Club, another story, another death has been Kurt Cobain's, and that's more recent. I remember when he died. I was in the 90s. I'm like, whoa. Was a big Kurt Cobain fan at the time, but I'm like, wow, that is a major impact on the music. And of course it was, he's just a junkie who OD'd, you know, nothing to see here. He's just a junkie. He ruined one of the most great bands there were in Nirvana. He's a junkie. And then I read the book Soaked in Bleach by Tom Grant. And for everybody out there, Tom Grant was the private investigator that Courtney Love hired about a week or so, very shortly before Kurt died.
Yeah, he went missing from rehab. There was an intervention at his home in Seattle. It was kind of staged. It wasn't necessary. He wasn't a heroin addict. In fact, even Dave Grohl refused to participate because he realized it was a complete canard. It was just a fiasco. So he was, he begrudgingly agreed to check himself into a rehab center in Marina del Rey mm-hmm. in California, and basically went in, signed the register, turned on his heels and marched right out again, disappeared into the night. And because he was basically missing for about a week until he was found in the greenhouse above his garage on April the 8th, that's when Courtney Love decided to hire Tom Grant. Conveniently, she was also in rehab in Beverly Hills, which Tom Grant thought at the time, wow, isn't that convenient? She has an alibi. These are all, of course, allegations, never been proven in court. She denies them vehemently. So I had to get that out of the way. But
allegedly.
Exactly. Allegedly, reportedly. Yes. So again, another, I mentioned earlier, this rush to judgment. We saw it with Brian Jones. We saw it with Jimi Hendrix. We saw it with Elvis. Oh, he died of a heart attack. No, he didn't. His heart was not the greatest for a 42-year-old man who ate deep fried banana and peanut butter sandwiches 4 or 5 days a week. He could have been a little healthier, but he had a full physical 3 weeks before he was about to launch on another tour. His heart was, he got a clean bill of health from the insurance company. So rush to judgment. Rush to judgment with Kurt Cobain as well, that it was a suicide. Oh, he's a heroin junkie. There's a suicide note. Look, he put a shotgun in his mouth. Case closed. Move on. Next. Whoops, not so fast. Not so fast. A lot of very nagging questions still surround the death of a Kurt Cobain.
Yeah, it really does. And then it goes back to kind of the same thing with Jeffries and Hendrix with Courtney and Kurt. Kurt was about ready to divorce Courtney. And she was like, that ain't happening. And then two, he's more valuable to her dead than alive because she owns the publishing rights. Everything that he owned now defaults to her because she's his wife. She is also, and this is according to Hank Harrison, her dad, which I knew, she's a straight up psychopath of the highest order. My daughter is a psychopath to the highest order. And just looking at all of the anomalies around that case and how conveniently the Seattle police, who Courtney, the lead investigator, was very, very good friends with the lead investigator. Everything got brushed under the rug. Nothing to see here. Looking at the forensic evidence, if you shot yourself in the head and your heart's pumping, there should be blood everywhere. But there wasn't. Huh? It was fired from a right-hand position, but he was left-handed. Huh? The length of the barrel to the trigger is one that you would have to use your toe to do. Huh? Oh, yeah. And after he took a lethal dose of 3 times the lethal dose of heroin, he conveniently was able to take his rig and put it back into his shoot-up box. Huh?
Yeah, he would have been rendered unconscious within seconds. 3 times the lethal. Now, that toxicology report, there's some dispute as to where that figure came. 3 times the lethal dose. Of course, heroin metabolizes in the blood as morphine. So three times the lethal dose of morphine. Some are speculating that was actually Courtney Love who put that out there. So there's some dispute about that. But you mentioned the shotgun.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not a hunter, but I have held shotguns in my hand. I know how cumbersome a weapon that can be. Mm-hmm. Add to the length of the barrel another 6 inches because there was a flash suppressor on the back, on the end of the shotgun. Okay. So unless he had arms like Abraham Lincoln, there's no way. Plus, of course, he's, under
whacked
the influence
out on Scooby
of
snacks.
Whacked out on. Yes, exactly. So he places the business end of the barrel in his mouth. What they call an inoral, it's inoral. He places the gun and you would imagine the exit wound would have been absolutely catastrophic. So in addition to blood, there would have been, sorry to be so graphic, there would have been brain splatter all over the place. None of that. None of that. The fingerprints on the weapon were unusable. There wasn't really any definitive linking of the fingerprints on the weapon to Kurt Cobain. You mentioned, you know, how implausible it is that he would be able to reach the trigger with his arm. Could he do it with his toe, perhaps? But both shoes were on when they found his body. Mm-hmm. I mean, it gets even more basic than this. They can't even determine the day of his death. Normally, you know, they can put time of death within 12 hours either side. And that's being, you know, very liberal. Mm-hmm. They can't even determine whether he died on April 5th, April 6th, or April 4th. So the whole timeline is very confusing as well. Then there's the suicide note, the so-called suicide note, which was found stabbed into a flower pot, the soil in a flower pot with a red pen. It's really two notes in one. The first part of the note, I suppose if in a stretch you could say it was a suicide, he was saying goodbye, but really it was more like a love letter to his fans and an explanation as to why he decided it was time for him to step back from the music industry, step back from Nirvana. He really hated what was happening in the music industry. He hated the way he was being branded. He absolutely detested as being known as the voice of a generation. He even started resenting the people that were showing up at his concerts. He just wanted out, and he wanted to dedicate more time to his daughter, Frances Bean, who he absolutely adored. He could have walked away. He was ready. So that's the first part of the note. The second part of the note seems to have been tacked on, and a number of, I think three, handwriting analysts have not testified in court, but have told researchers it doesn't match. The handwriting in the second half of the note does not match the first half. Now, it gets even more sinister, let's say. Tom Grant, you mentioned the private investigator, hired by Courtney to find Kurt after he disappeared. Tom Grant got to speaking with their lawyer, Rosemary Carroll. Rosemary was Kurt and Courtney's lawyer. Mm-hmm. They both discovered what they referred to as practice sheets that were found, I believe, in a backpack that belonged to Courtney. As if she were practicing Kurt's handwriting style. Well, she needed more practice because, again, these handwriting analysts say, not a match, not even close. So the second part of that note, written in another person's hand, that's when it becomes more overt, you know, goodbye, Courtney, goodbye, Frances Bean, I can't go on, that sort of thing. So again, that's pretty suspect. And you mentioned the divorce. There were rumors that they were thinking of divorce, but Rosemary Carroll also came forward and said that the will had been changed. Kurt had changed the will, but he hadn't signed it yet. So the timing of his demise was of the essence, if that was indeed the motive.
It sounds like there was, you know, when I look at it, my thing is, yeah, Courtney might not have fulfilled the hit, but she put the hit out. And the rest is history. Nothing to see here, folks. Rest of judgment. He's a junkie.
Allegedly
reported. Just so many people have died. I mean, it's like I wanted to get into a little bit of the Jimi Hendrix and the woohoo things. We're down to about 20 minutes left. So, and I also wanted to cover, touch your friends. What happened to your friend? Because that when you're telling me on the pre-show about that experience, and I've had things like that happen, not that exact same one, but things you just can't explain. So God, I really want to get into the OTO stuff, but I think that we don't have enough time, and I want to cover your friend, what happened with that. So why don't we just skip the loo, my darling, and give us a background on your friend, who he was, what he meant to you, and then just take it from there.
So the book is dedicated in part to my late collaborator, partner, R. Gary Patterson, my friend, R. Gary Patterson. He was a great musician. He was known as the Fox Mulder of rock and roll. He wrote probably the definitive book on the whole Paul is Dead legend. It was called The Walrus Was Paul. Now, our Gary Patterson was writing sort of from a skeptical point of view. He didn't believe that Paul McCartney was dead, and we share that view, but he did examine the clues in great detail, and he loved to talk about all the clues on Sgt. Pepper. Every time we got together, he'd pull out that straight edge mirror and point out all the different clues. Oh, look, there's a hand over Paul's head in Eastern mysticism. You know, that's a blessing on the dead. Look, that little doll, you know, covered in blood, and she's sitting on someone's lap, and that person is wearing a bloodied racing glove, left-handed. You know, the whole album cover is a funereal scene. Anyway, he loved to talk about that. And then coincidentally, he died on the 50th, he died on the 50th anniversary of the release of Sgt. Pepper in the UK, May 17th, 2017. The album came out May 17th, 1967. Anyway, we were working to launch a radio program. It was called The Spirit of Rock. It later became a podcast after he died called The Rock and Roll Twilight Zone. But we were in communication constantly by phone. I forget what we were using back in the 2015, 2016, 2017. I don't know if Google Meeting was around then, but we were constantly three, four, five times a week. We were having, you know, meetings and collaborating online and over the phone, trying to launch this radio show. And we had produced a pilot. And Gary lived down in Oliver Springs, Tennessee, a little coal mining Civil War era town just outside of Knoxville. And so he had met with the general manager at a radio station in Knoxville, played the pilot, and he loved it, and he wanted the show on the air. We were getting ready to launch, and we thought this will be our flagship station, and maybe eventually we'll get it syndicated, and we'll build a bit of a network. Then Gary dies. And how I found out about it is kind of strange, but I should back up. The night he died, or the day he died, I got a phone call from Gary. Nothing unusual there. I remember I was in the basement, just in the room adjacent to my studio here. I saw his name come up on my call display, caller ID, R. Gary Patterson. And it was pitch black out. I remember this because it was a weird night, but I was wandering around my house with the phone talking to Gary, and he had called to tell me that the meeting that he was to have to finalize things for the radio show in Knoxville had been postponed because this was on a Friday. It was supposed to take place on the Monday, the next Monday. Monday was Memorial Day in the United States. So we were heading into Memorial Day weekend. And then Gary said some things to me that were just kind of out of the blue and strange. He said to me, you know, Richard, you're a really cool dad. And I thought, what's that all about? Why would he say that? I mean, Gary was one of the most easygoing, friendliest persons I ever met. Never heard a sour tone in his voice in all the years I knew him. And then a little while later, he said to me, you know, Richard, you and I are a really big deal. And I thought, okay, this is Gary's way of sort of building us up, you know, building up our confidence. We're about to launch this radio show. And I'm wandering the house with the phone to my ear, and I wander through the kitchen, and my wife is in the kitchen with my brother-in-law, her brother. They watch me pass through the kitchen. And then the next thing I know, I'm in another part of the house, and it's just very strange. Everything about this, it's almost surreal. But I know that it's dark out. It's pitch black out. And in May 17th, I looked it up recently, the sun sets at around 8:30. Well, it was pitch black out. So I'm guessing it was 9, 10 o'clock at night when he called. Anyway, before we hung up the phone, the last thing I said to Gary was, so Memorial Day weekend coming up, are you going to have a barbecue? And for the first time in all the years I knew Gary, he got kind of curt with me. And he said, just flatly, there will be no barbecue. And I thought, oh dear, have I stepped in a landmine here? Have I opened up some, I don't know, wound? Is there something going on with his family? There'll be no barbecue. I don't even remember how the call ended. I don't remember asking him, is the meeting going to be rescheduled in Knoxville? I don't remember any of that. I just remember there will be no barbecue. I hung up the phone. That night, the mighty Aphrodite, that's my lovely bride, we went to bed, and every night since we've been married, we listened to Coast AM. That night, we both fell asleep. We missed the entire show. Very out of the ordinary. Never happened before. We fell asleep, missed the show. Had we listened, I would have heard the guest host that night, Dave Schrader, announce that R. Gary Patterson had died that day. R. Gary was a regular on Coast to Coast with George Norrie, talking about all the things we're talking about now. So I wake up the next morning, unaware that Gary has passed. I go down the stairs, out the front door, sit on the porch with my coffee, checking emails, Facebook messages. There's a Facebook message from Dave Schrader saying, "Richard, I don't know if you heard the show last night. I know you were good friends with our Gary. Thought you'd like to know he died yesterday." And I laughed. I thought, give me a break. I just talked to Gary last night. I call Gary's phone. I get the outgoing message. "Gary, it's Richard. Some confusion here. The folks at Coast seem to think you're dead. Give me a call." I waited. No call, because it ended up being true. I rush upstairs. The mighty Aphrodite is just climbing out of bed. She sees my ashen complexion. She says, she can tell there's something wrong. "What happened? What's wrong?" I said, "Gary's dead." And without my prompting her, she said, "You were just talking to him last night." And I said, I thought I was. She said, "Well, check your recents on your phone." I checked. There was no incoming call that Friday night. There was no outgoing call. In fact, I didn't talk to anybody on the phone, according to my recents. Now, he did call on Wednesday. I remember that. I was picking my boys up from Greek school. I remember the call. We talked about his upcoming meeting in Knoxville. There was the call from Gary on Wednesday. Nothing on the Friday. So I flew down to Knoxville and then took a cab into Oliver Springs to attend the funeral. There's Gary in this beautiful blue, metallic blue coffin. He's got his Fender guitar up on a little stand in front of the casket. There's his brother, Mike, who I'd never met in person, but Gary and I spoke of his brother quite often. Went up to pay my condolences, shook Mike's hand. He was so appreciative that I'd made it down from Toronto. And he said, "Gary spoke of you often, and he was so excited about this radio program." So I asked Mike two questions. I didn't tell him about the phone call that had happened the night he died. I said, "Mike, two things. What time did Gary pass?" And it was sudden. It was a heart attack. He said it was about 5 o'clock. 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And I'm thinking, wait a minute. It was well past dark when I talked to him. I didn't let on that I'd spoken to Mike about this. It wasn't the time or the place. Then I said, "Last time I spoke to your brother, I asked him if he was having a barbecue on Memorial Day weekend. And he was kind of curt with me. He said, there'll be no barbecue. Any idea why Gary would say that to me?" And Michael looked at me. He cocked his head. He looked very confused. He said, "He said that to you?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "There'll be no barbecue." And he said, "That's funny." He said, "Because that afternoon, the day he died, he was driving all over town looking for a brand new barbecue. He ended up spending $500 on this, I don't know if it was a Napoleon grill, this beautiful grill. And then he spent the rest of the afternoon, up until he died practically, putting that thing together. There was no barbecue. Gary knew there would be no barbecue." So am I misremembering things? Am I conflating things? I am open to any and all possibilities, because there's hardly a day that goes by that I don't think about what happened just past 9 years ago. I can't explain it. I won't even pretend I have the answers. I'm conflicted by it. as an Orthodox Christian, that, you know, why me of all people? If Gary was reaching out from beyond the grave, would he call me, not members of his family? Maybe he did. I don't know. But that's all detailed in chapter 16 of the book. And the title of the chapter is There Will Be No Barbecue. Oh, I think you're on mute there.
Oh, I am. Well, you're thank back. You there. I'm back. Hey, there you go. There you go. Yeah, I've had things that I can't describe happen to me. And from a Christian standpoint, I understand that when you talk about the infinite compared to the finite mind cannot comprehend the infinite reality. So there has to be some liaison between it. Mm-hmm. That's where the Bible and religion comes in, to bridge that gap between the two. And the thing that I've learned is that the world, the universe, life, whatever one wants to call it, is far more mysterious than what we give it credit for. And things exist out of our realms of perception that we know nothing of. An experience that happened to me was I was a teenager. My aunt lived on an Indian reservation in the Sierra Nevada mountain range. And I had this very short but emotionally powerful dream. And it was just me at night standing out in the forest, looking at the back of a Volkswagen, an old oxidized Volkswagen with the hood off, and right next to me was this big tree. So the whole next day, I'm tripping on this dream. Partly why I'm tripping on this dream is, why am I tripping on this dream? It was quick. It was just blah, 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 blah. And it was just constantly on my mind all day long. Later that evening, my cousin comes over, and everybody on the reservation is related and the town. And he's like, hey, man, why don't we go over to my place? I want to show you my car that I'm working on. Well, okay, so we wandered a mile or so down the road and go to his property, and he lives. And he says, hey, man, there's my car. Richard, I kid you not, I was looking at the same car in the same forest with the same tree on my left-hand side. Now, as a teenager, that was a real eye-opener and a little bit of a brain breaker, that how did this happen? There is nothing in physics, there's nothing in science, and I was a science geek to the bone, that could explain the experience I just had. Now, to somebody who's never had those esoteric experiences, I mean, honestly, no explanation will be suffice, but those that have, no explanation is needed. So when you get into your experience, I'm like, yeah, that is definitely in the realms of possibility. I've had things like that with, my best friend, my ex-girlfriend, about, oh my God, 16 years ago, died suddenly of ovarian cancer. Like within 3 weeks, she was from, oh, I don't feel good. A little over three, was dead. Okay. Checked out, up with the angels. Well, I remember, and I was her medical advocate. So it was my responsibility, as per her directions, that she was not going to be hooked on life support. I was the one that had to make the call to pull the plug. So we had a celebration in the hospital, and I said, okay, doc, it's time to go. And I just broke. I just lost it. I said, I can't be around here, man. I can't deal with this. So I went off to the parking lot and had a cigarette. It's back when I used to smoke. And I heard her voice audibly in my head, Richard, saying, David, where are you? I'm scared. Where are you? And, oh, I'm getting chills thinking about that.
Me too. Me too.
And I was just like, oh, shit, I need to get back. And I sprinted full force to get to her room within about a minute of them turning off everything. And we watched her EKG go deet, 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 deet. So, yeah, man, this is a strange thing. And, you know, part of what I wanted to get into is the esoteric. You know, the Jimmy Colts, the Aleister Crowleys and everything like that, but we're flat out running out of time, my friend.
You'll have to have me back. It's that simple.
I will have to have you back. And we'll get down and funky, and we'll get all occulty and Aleister Crowley and lame, and, you know, everything like that. But I've really enjoyed our conversation tonight, and I just can't believe that we're already at the end of the show. That's why I love conversations. They take on a life of their own, and the next thing you know, you're like, oh, we're done. Damn, it's like, right, it's like the roller coaster ride. Just as you're like, yeah, right on. All of a sudden you go over the last hump and you go in there to get off the ride and let somebody else go in there.
It's like a helter skelter. That's another chapter in the book.
I've got pages, a couple of pages of notes and everything on that book. So before we get out of here, why don't you let everybody know once again where you can be found, where your book, when your book's going to go on sale, where they can get it. And also, everybody, if you're going to buy it, it's probably on everybody else. But if you can, buy it from Trine Day, buy it from the publisher, buy it from Chris Milligan. I'm sure you probably get a better cut than Amazon. And plus, you're supporting local businesses, real businesses, not the megalith AI companies are out there. So with that being said, I will pass the torch to you, Mr. Richard.
All right. First, I'll give a plug for my podcast, Richard Serrett's Strange Planet. Drops every Monday, Wednesday, Friday, available wherever you find your podcast, Spotify, iTunes, Apple, you name it. Strangeplanet.ca is the website, strangeplanet.ca for Canada. You can also subscribe to my free monthly newsletter from the website. It's called Inner Sanctum, and the newsletters are a little more, let's say, subversive. I recently published the June issue, which was about the tick agenda and the strange alpha gel red meat allergy, perhaps as a result of Lone Star tick bites and the connection to Bill Gates and so forth. Inner Sanctum, strangeplanet.ca. I'll be doing Coast to Coast on July 24th and 25th. The book, Tales from the Rock and Roll Twilight Zone. You can find out more information at therockandrolltwilightzone.com, therockandrolltwilightzone.com. Available for pre-order. Pre-order is important, I'm told. I'm new to this business, but if you could pre-order, that would be great. It comes out July 9th.
Well, fantastic. Everybody go out there when that thing comes out and get yourself a good book and support this man. By the way, while you were talking about your podcast, I went on here because I'm on a Mac and I subscribe to your podcast. So you have a new listener, Richard, me.
Thank you, Nature Boy.
You're welcome. So yeah, we're definitely gonna have to come back on. But with that, I'm going to put a pin in this because it's time for me to go make some dinner. And being that I'm the cook, bottle washer, and maitre d' altogether, if I don't feed myself, ain't nobody going to do it. So with that being said, everybody, thanks all you badass savages in the chats. Y'all have been just off the charts tonight. Thanks to everybody who's listening out there live. If you're listening down the road, thank you. If you're listening on my audio podcast, thank you. And also, if you haven't followed the show, whether it be an audio podcast or the video, could you just hit that follow button? And if you're on the audio, leave me a comment. Even if it says, Nature Boy, you suck, get off the air. Give me 5-star ratings with that because that helps me in the algorithms. So, I love my hate listeners. All right. So that being said, it is a worldwide broadcast. I have listeners from all over the world. So wherever you're listening or watching this show, you have a good day. You have a better night, and we'll see you next Friday.